If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Thank you, Bob Kessler. It's John Williams. How are you? Here until 3 o'clock on WGN Radio. And lots to talk about on the show today. Bob, you and I haven't visited in a while. I hope
know.
You're doing well.
I saw you at the Christmas broadcast.
I was just gonna say. You and were killing it with your harmonica playing that you were. It was harmonica, right?
That was me, yes. And I played Penny Whistle on one song.
That was...
I spare no expense.
That was the biggest shindig I have been a part of in many years of radio. The whole staff and everybody just playing a part. And I mean, literally, like from small parts to big parts, speaking on the microphone to you guys playing, you know, the music. It was just something else to see the talent in that room. I don't know if it was great radio, but it sure was fun to do.
It was fun. Of course it was great radio because it was fun.
Well, I think that's what comes through too, isn't it? It's like, even if that wasn't seamless and it wasn't supposed to be, you could tell that's just a bunch of people celebrating Christmas on the radio, live, spontaneously, and how often do you hear that? So we've moved on from Christmas to the political season. And I'm not going to talk too much politics on the show today. We do enough as it is, although our Mincing Rascals segment after 1:30 will dip into that. More about that a little later. This week I've also been kind of captured by and talking about the O.J. Simpson story and the Bernie Madoff story, because miniseries about those two are now out. The Madoff series has come and gone. I'm going to actually talk to somebody about the Bernie Madoff story in the 2 o'clock hour. And the O.J. Simpson story is just getting started, and who knew it would be that good? Another story that captured my attention this week was the Martin Shkreli story. He's that pharmaceutical giant who took the drug that a lot of people need to live who suffer from AIDS from $13.50 a pill to $5,000 a pill. No. It went to $750 a pill. It was an increase of 5,000%. And I asked my listeners, what's the most that you're paying for a prescription, a drug that you have to take? What is it costing? This one says, John, the acne medicine Accutane for my teenage son is $780 a month, and it's a minimum treatment of 6 months. Wow. John, $400 a month for one asthma medication. Hey, John, my daughter had an acne issue. The pills were $500 a month for a supply. I had a high deductible, so I had to pay for it all. Be $100 in Canada. Hey, John, anti-rejection meds after kidney transplant. One prescription my son needs is $1,800 a month. We always reach the $3,000 deductible in January. Hey, John, we pay for two types of insulin, $250 a month, and on it goes. So it's not unusual to see somebody charging that much, but he seems to be particularly unscrupulous, in part because his testimony this week, did you see the video, this Martin Shkreli guy?
Oh, yeah.
He's looking
didn't
at
bode
the congressman.
Well.
He's smirking. He's literally laughing when one of the congressmen implored him to have some mercy on these people. He just sort of chuckled and shook his head.
He didn't get it at all, and I wonder what's going on with that guy mentally, psychologically.
No, I think that's exactly what I was thinking too, Bob, because when you read his bio, he was a bit of a savant. He dropped out of high school at the age of 17. He was managing a financial fund at like 19. You know, he's just one of these kids who's always been too smart for the room and a little too smug for it as well. So he thumbs his nose at all these members of Congress. And then he stands up and he walks out after pleading the fifth. Every time they asked a question, he would just say, I'll invoke my right not to incriminate myself. One of the congressmen said, Shkreli, is that how you pronounce it? And he said, yeah. And the congressman says, aha, see, you can answer a question. You don't have to. Everything you say will not necessarily be used against you. You can talk to us. I don't know if it was wise for him to not talk to them, since maybe he will be indicted or brought up on charges. But the way he did it, you're right, Bob, was just such bad form. So he stands up to walk out. And he walks out of the halls of Congress there, down the steps, and you know how these guys operate, right into the waiting black SUV. And he walks up to the vehicle and is about to get in, looks in, and goes, ooh, wrong car.
I didn't see that.
Oh, God, it was so priceless because he had managed the moment just the way he wanted. I'm so cool. Here's the waiting black SUV. Sort of the way when Rostenkowski got out of jail and a late model Buick pulls up. He jumps in and the tires squeal and off they go. It's like such a classic moment. So he's about to have his classic peel-out moment and it's the wrong car. And then he turns kind of sheepishly the way I would, but I'm not Satan. And he goes, my bad. It was very, very funny. There's a story in the Chicago Tribune today by Hal Dardick, and it's reflective of what the Chicago Tribune has also editorialized about this week, and that is the George Lucas Art Center that they want to build on the lakefront. Here's the way Hal Dardick started his story in the Trib today. Mayor Rahm Emanuel on Friday said he will talk to Star Wars creator George Lucas and financier wife Melody Hobson to figure out what's next for the filmmaker's narrative art museum, a day after a federal court judge indicated that the lakefront location could violate state law. After all has been said and done about this project, remember when it first happened, we were like, oh, cool, we won, we got it, the way maybe the South Side feels because they'll get an Obama library. I think a lot of us in Chicago thought we scored. Then you saw what it was going to look like inside and out, and you're sort of scratching your head. It's not really a Star Wars thing. It's a narrative art, whatever that is, thing, and it's over my head. And then you realize the real estate they're going to get for about nothing, and it started to make me wonder if that was such a swell deal for us all, too. In the Tribune, the editorial talked about how it was or is now that maybe they won't even be able to put it there, which is strike 12 for Mayor Emanuel this week, if you're keeping score. John McCormick is on the Chicago Tribune editorial board and wrote that piece. John, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thanks. Thanks, John.
Am I right so far in my general description of this thing?
You've nailed it. I don't know if it was strike 12 or strike 14, but I may have lost count.
Mayor Emanuel's had a bad week. But this is weird because it seems to me like this is something we should have figured out a long time ago. George Lucas is probably saying that. Wait a minute, after I can't have that land that you guys promised me? What happened there, John?
City Hall in a big rush to secure the project for Chicago. And by the way, I think the project would be a good thing for Chicago anywhere but along the lakefront.
Yeah.
The City Hall, we don't know the ins and outs. We don't know who demanded or who offered, but Mr. Lucas wound up with a promise that he could have 17 acres of lakefront land. It's now basically a parking area between Soldier Field and McCormick Place.
Yeah.
And he could also have it for 3 centuries. Now, he does have to pay $10 a century. Well, it's 99 years. But he has to pay $10 for a 99-year lease of 17 acres. That's not even $10 per acre, but
What's the logic behind that, John? Why do you, I know that's not perfect real estate there, but that's lakefront in Chicago. Why do we give it to them for so little?
I would say it is perfect real estate, John. I'm hard pressed to think of, too many places on earth that are worth more than a 17 acre plot on Lake Michigan in the middle of a fabulous metropolis. But issue really isn't the issue that's hanging this up in court and appears as though it is going to render this land just plain unusable for this project. It really doesn't have anything to do with what a fabulous deal Mr. Lucas struck, but with the fact that this land has special protections. It's not like the Grant Park protections. There are all kinds of different layers of protection. But this is pretty fabulous protection, and it's not going to allow essentially a private museum to wind up on your and my lakefront.
The doctrine is that, or essentially states that, that's public space, and we all are entitled to use it, and you can't give it or sell it on the cheap to even a well-intended private concern.
The key word, you said it perfectly, and the key word there is private. There's a reason why the Field Museum is there. There's a reason even why McCormick Place is there. But you have to have legislative, you have to have the state government. This land, John, it's It's called public trust land. And here's how it works. There's a reason that you and I can walk around, let's say, Lake Geneva, where there are a lot of mansions. Mm-hmm. And we don't own the mansions. We don't own the land they sit on. But we do have a right to walk around that lake. Think of it as kind of an easement. This is better than an easement, though. All 13 million residents of Illinois own this land. It used to be Lake Michigan bottom land, the floor of Lake Michigan. In the 1920s, our predecessors put a landfill on top of it. But that lake bottom down there still has this special protection, and it always will. Oddly, the crowning U.S. Supreme Court case on this comes right out of Chicago. When in the 1800s, the city, long story, I'm going to say the city tried to give the Illinois Central a big chunk of what's now Grant Park. But because of the public trust doctrine, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no way, you can't do this. State of Illinois, you can't just give this stuff away. You are the trustee of this land for all 13 million of us. I own a part of that land. So do you.
Every one of us, yeah, owns a little bit of that land. And so it almost doesn't matter if I like the idea or not.
And I get to use that land. If someone can come up with a really compelling reason, like maybe building a war memorial, and let's call it Soldier Field, on former lake bottom land, the legislature can say, okay, that's good enough. That's a public purpose.
Well, did not the legislature pass on this, John? I guess not, huh? They didn't.
They did.
The state of Illinois did not give it.
They did, and that's something that in the judge's ruling this week, he basically, he's a very nice, polite man. He would never be rude, but if he was a rude man, he would have said, I keep rejecting you on this, and you keep coming back to me. On the legislature part, last year, folks in Springfield, I believe it was last year, folks in Springfield decided we're going to do what we need to do to enable a Barack Obama museum on the south side. All well and good. They tacked on an amendment which said, oh, by the way, park districts up and down the lake can let people use this public trust doctrine land. It's okay with us. The judge says, whoa, hold on. This isn't just land that the state owns. The legislature isn't an owner like maybe you own a house. This is much more sacred. This is public trust land.
Right, but is the judge – let me cut you off, John. The judge is essentially saying, is he not, that whatever you guys think, I'm not persuaded that you're using it for the public good, right?
The judge did not say in so many words, that was really a cute little trick to try and get around public trust doctrine by tacking it on to a popular piece of legislation. But, this is ridiculous. You're not allowed to – you can't give away the right to protect this land to a bunch of park districts.
Okay, hold on, John. I got to take a break. Let me take a break because when I come back for just one last quick segment on this, the question is this. It's not going to be rejected in that location because I don't like the looks of it or what a sweet deal it was. It's going to be rejected because of what you've just described. But I wonder what our audience thinks, though, of this deal generally now anyway. And the Tribune didn't editorialize on that point, but I'm interested in your thoughts at 312-981-7200. Should we tell them to go somewhere else, including San Francisco? Would you be willing to give up the whole thing in the name of saving that piece of real estate? 312-981-7200. You can call me now. This is WGN. It's 127. John McCormick, editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune, is on the line. We're just talking about that museum of narrative art that they're putting up, or maybe aren't putting up now, over on the lakefront out by McCormick Place. And, John, you aren't really talking about whether or not that's a good use of the land. You're talking about the law and the principle. You aren't editorializing on, is that a cool museum? Is it ugly? Is it a good, is it helping the city that way? That's not your angle on this, is it?
Well, I mean, we would love to see Mr. Lucas put his museum in Chicago. It would draw some tourists. It would create jobs. We've been very positive. As frankly, I mean, the lawsuit we're talking about was brought by an advocacy group called Friends of the Parks. They too would like to see this built, just not on the lakefront.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just do you know the story behind that, though? I mean, why did we give? Is it because otherwise he'd put it in San Francisco or some other city? So to lure him here, we gave him such a sweet deal.
I think it would be good for you to give Mayor Emanuel a buzz this afternoon and say, what on earth were you thinking, and what kind of legal advice did you get on this? Public trust doctrine is not a mystery, and this is something that you and I as laymen, you know, may never have heard of. It's a notion that dates back to the Roman Empire. An emperor named Justinian came up with this idea that...
Really? Well, things, you know, what you mentioned a little while ago... You
if
mentioned
the mayor
a little while
over
ago.
For a beer tonight, ask him.
Well, you know, you were talking about Lake Geneva and how there's that easement. Just this past summer,
it's like
was
an
at
easement.
But it's really neat. And I had
it's
only
better.
I only
it's
recently had I been to Lake Geneva for the first time. And so we're out on a boat. We're looking at all these lovely houses, and I'm seeing all of these people walk around the houses. And I thought, well, I guess if I lived in one of these mansions, I would have all my friends over, and we would spend a lot of time outside. And they said, no, that's people from Illinois and the surrounding community, and they're able to walk in front of, between the mansion and the water, where there's these fabulous lawns. There's a public walkway that the people have. And I guess the principle that we all have a right to use that waterfront is essentially what they're saying here should keep
Yes.
Lucas and Emanuel from hijacking that bit of real estate.
Exactly. I can't go up to Lake Geneva, put up a hot dog stand on the lakefront, and keep you from using the land. I can't control. That's the key word here. If you want to think about one word, it's who controls the land. The judge essentially said this week, wait a second, you're taking public trust land and you're giving control of it to a billionaire. He may be a great guy, and we all hope he comes to Chicago somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. John McCormick, the editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. All right, I'm out of time. I will talk to you another day, John. It's always a pleasure to visit with you. Thanks for your time and expertise, sir.
Thanks, as always, John. Take care.
Okay, there he goes. It's 1:30. Old neighbor friend of mine. Let's pause. We'll update you on the news. The Mincing Rascals have a few things to mince about. This will be fun. One of the funniest lines of the week in that segment coming up here on WGN. There was a disagreement on the Lou Manfredini Mr. Fix-It show this morning between the news and programming departments. Lou wanted it to be colder and more typically wintry. You know, he wanted more snow. He wanted colder temperatures. Where are you on that, Bob Kessler? You
I'm fine with this. This is kind of like, I don't know, maybe a Nashville type of winter where it doesn't get quite so cold.
And not to get paranoid about it, but I'm one of these people that subscribes to the ill effects of global warming and climate change. This isn't that really. This is more El Nino, but probably they're related. And you almost feel a little greedy or selfish if you say, hey, this global warming thing is working out. It's working out good for you and me. Now we live in Nashville, but our kids and grandkids might suffer for it, you know, because they're going to end up living in Phoenix and, you know, Guatemala or someplace for the weather. And that's not the way it's supposed to be in Chicago, Illinois. It's weird. It's weird to me. Let's do the Mincing Rascals segment. We drop this podcast every Friday. As I mentioned, it's Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio, Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie, who are columnists and editorial writers from the Chicago Tribune. And we usually talk politics in this segment, and then I like to play back part of the podcast. It usually runs 20 to 30 minutes. We're at about 30 this week. We talk about a number of topics nationally and locally. We'll focus more on a couple of local topics here, although in our partial playback, we'll start with Eric Zorn's comment on Bernie Sanders' chances.
He's not going to be the president of the United States.
Well, if you like progressive ideas, Eric, and you do, I just want to give you guys three words to mince on, and then we'll talk about it probably never. Ranked choice voting. I sent Eric an email about this week. Ranked choice voting. We have it in Minnesota. Other states and cities have it as well. And that means that if you can go ahead and vote for Bernie Sanders, and then when they count the votes, you go, well, Bernie Sanders actually finished last. Okay, then we take the person who finished last off, and then we count your next vote. And that could be for Hillary Clinton, or it could be for Bingo the dog. It gives you the opportunity to vote for candidates that will not win traditionally, and you don't want to vote for them because you think, well, my vote's not going to count. Why would I vote for Bernie Sanders? But you can. If he finishes at the bottom, then they'll take your next vote, your second vote. And then you keep doing that until somebody gets a majority. That's how we elect the mayor in Minneapolis. Minneapolis elects its mayor that way.
It's also called instant runoff voting, I think.
If we're talking about the same thing, call it what you will. Here we call it ranked choice voting. But it's a very interesting and not illegal idea. But it gives you a chance to vote, say, three times on the election. Who would be your first, second, and third choice? You could say, I like Rubio. No. More to the point, you could say, I like Trump. I want to vote for Trump, but I don't think Trump's going to win. So I don't want to vote for Trump. I want to throw my vote with somebody who I think is going to win. Well, go ahead and vote for Trump. And then if Trump doesn't win, they'll take your second place vote or your third place vote.
Here's the answer to that is two words, Harold Washington.
Yeah, why?
Harold Washington would not have been elected mayor of Chicago if we'd had preferential voting back in, was it, 82?
You mean because he won by a narrow margin with 83. Three candidates?
Or well, there were two white candidates, Jane Byrne and Rich Daley, and him, and he won with like 31% of the vote. I am sure that the second choice of most of those white voters who voted for Rich Daley was Byrne and vice versa. So that if you had had that ranked voting, it's probably
he would not have won. Yeah, but and the question is, all right, well then what's the better reflection of the will of the people? And maybe it wouldn't be Harold Washington.
I'm not saying it's a perfect answer to your. I'm just saying that is an answer. Is that it does?
Yeah, but if you want to distill what the will of the people is, maybe the fact that Harold Washington won or Jesse Ventura became governor of Minnesota once upon a time with less than 40% of the vote, maybe that's – think about it. 60-plus percent of the people of Minnesota said they didn't want Ventura, and most people said they didn't want Harold Washington. If you had ranked choice voting, Washington and Ventura would not have won, and that would have appeased the largest percentage of people. Okay, you guys ready for your next subject here?
Hit us.
Kristen McQuarrie, you wrote about Mike Madigan and the stranglehold he has on state politics today.
I always make the argument that there is one person that is, you know, has the stranglehold on government. And Eric was making the point that you remove Mike Madigan and replace him with somebody else, you're still going to have the same stalemate. And I don't agree with that. I think Madigan is a unique figure. He's been the House Speaker for, I think, 32 of the last 40 years. That he's been in Springfield, 45. And so every part of state government, he has his fingers in. And so I referenced the House rules, which each General Assembly every 2 years passes the House rules. And they basically dictate how a bill is introduced and passed. And it just shows he has his thumb on everything that happens in Springfield, every step of the way. And really, to me, there's no question that not only does he have the most control, but he bears the most responsibility for the condition that the state of Illinois is in now.
You said nothing gets to the governor that doesn't first get through Madigan. You said Madigan has ignored legislation to raise the minimum wage, pass a progressive income tax, institute term limits, reform the redistricting process, allow for an elected school board in Chicago, and end the city's red light camera program. And that's not all you said. I mean, really, You paint a picture of him as the most powerful gatekeeper in the state of Illinois, right?
Well, he is, in my opinion. And I point out those progressive agenda items because Mike Madigan is a Democrat. And there's this belief that somehow he is, you know, representing the middle class and representing these populist ideas, when in fact he uses his own rules to not put things in front of the people. And he uses that, you know, these are Democratic principles mantra as a reason that he keeps blocking Bruce Rauner's agenda, the Republican governor, when in fact he blocks his own, you know, progressive wing of his own party's agenda routinely.
When I saw that, I thought, wait a minute, those sound like Democratic ideas.
They are.
Do you think
that's why
he would like
out
those mm-hmm. ideas? Yeah.
Well, I found my colleague's arguments pretty persuasive, actually, in terms of Madigan's power and his unique power in the state. I will say, though, that on some of these key points that are creating the stalemate in Illinois, the union rules, the right to work zones, the workers' comp things, that the Democratic Party is fairly united on those. I don't think that if Madigan were to resign tomorrow to spend more time with his family, that you would suddenly have a new leader come in and say, "Okay, we're going to make deals with Governor Rauner on these key sticking points."
That wasn't the point. I hear you, but that wasn't the point.
No, I know it wasn't the point. But so I say, I think you made an excellent argument that Madigan is like I say, uniquely powerful, maybe in Illinois history as a speaker.
Well, then what is the point, Kristen?
So I followed Springfield for 20 years. I was down there a lot early in my career and watched the committee process. The column I wrote was just sort of like an instructional, here is what actually happens day to day in Springfield. And I'm told by readers that those kinds of columns are helpful because they really don't understand the process. They're not sure why Madigan has so much power.
Well, you described the playbook that the House has versus the Senate and how not only is it longer, the rules book, but that it's peppered with, you know, at the discretion of the speaker, things like that. I've always thought he was an impediment to the better lives of the people of Illinois.
It's not personal. I don't have anything personal against Madigan. I just think he's been down there too long. Anybody who had the amount of power that he's had and has served that long in government and where people defer to you all the time, it's toxic. It changes you. It changes your outlook. I just don't think he's in it anymore and hasn't been for decades, you know, to actually help the people. He's there to help, you know, keep Democrats in power and himself.
Well, yeah, so that's the question. What is he for?
He's for us, a majority, keeping a majority in the House.
That's it.
Well, but boy, that's sad, isn't it? That's just little petty politics, isn't it, Kristen? I mean, are you really think it's that shallow?
I do. He's not in it for policy. He does not care about policy. If he did, we wouldn't have, you know, $111 billion in unfunded pension liabilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I can't define for you what Mike Madigan's agenda is for the future of Illinois. I mean, we know his agenda is to hang on to power. But what is his agenda for bringing business back here, for bringing back up the middle class, for, you know, solving the pension problem? I can't articulate that. And I follow this stuff not quite as closely as Kristen does, but very closely. And I can't tell you what that is. I can't tell you what the Democratic turnaround agenda is. And I think that's a problem when you're trying to sort of pick sides and figure out what's going on here. Is, okay, if I don't like what Rauner wants to do, but I know something has to be done other than we're not going to change anything, things are going fine, which they're not. The Democrats have, I think, failed to articulate what their vision is.
That's Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune. And, of course, you heard the voice of Steve Bertrand, part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's on my Facebook page every Friday. It's there right now. I'm King John on Facebook. It's at WGNplus.com as well. At the end of each podcast, I always ask the gang to give me something that they would recommend to you, something that we are all reading, listening to, or watching that you might benefit from knowing about. And Eric Zorn cited this week as his recommendation the 49th most popular podcast in America this week. It is the dang strangest podcast you'll ever hear of. He'll tell you about that after this on WGN. WGN Radio News with Bob Kessler in about 8 minutes. We'll do that at 2 o'clock. This is John Williams. One last note about our Mincing Rascals podcast, which you can check out at WGNplus.com or on the John Williams Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. Remember, at the end of each podcast, I ask the gang to recommend something that we're all tuned to, and maybe that would be something you would benefit from knowing about. It's usually a book or a movie or a TV show or something like that. But this week, Eric Zorn said there's a particular other podcast he wanted to recommend. This is that.
The 49th most popular podcast in America this week is something called Sleep With Me, which is a fascinating podcast. And it is essentially, it's a podcast that's meant to be listened to if you're having trouble falling asleep. And this guy tells these stories that are like...
seem to be self-defeating,
well,
but go ahead.
No, but they're he's got this.
Are
kind
we
of,
on it?
He's got this kind of... You know, maybe we got a franchise here.
I think this has been one of your picks before.
No,
this
it hasn't been. I just discovered this. And the guy does, he tells these stories, and they're filled with, like, detail that's kind of like the way a boring person kind of goes off in these tangents. And people in the reviews, they say, God, you know, I can't, for 10 minutes he's got this kind of droning voice, but it's not deliberately droning. It's just you listen to it and you're just like, oh my God. And people swear by it as a great way to get to sleep, called Sleep With Me.
This guy will put you to sleep.
Yeah, that's a problem for all of us in radio and podcasting. In fact, a clip from that podcast is at the end of the Mincing Rascals podcast. You'll see what Steve and Eric are talking about. Here's one other sample from our podcast this week. This is my conversation we do weekly with Thomas Jefferson, who's not a big fan or friend of Alexander Hamilton, I was out talking to him for the entire podcast, only about 12 or 13 minutes, about Super Bowl parties the two of them would host. And a short summary of that goes like this. This is John Williams reaching out to our old friend Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good to talk with you, my friend.
You want to come to my Super Bowl party?
I don't know. I would have to bring a book. You know, in my time, we would have regarded this, that something like a huge number of Americans watching the same gladiatorial event, we would have immediately gone back to our Roman history, and we would have concluded, I think, John Adams certainly and I, that this is a sign of the death of America. When you start to move towards bread and circuses and the Colosseum, mass entertainments for the people that involve nothing to do with the quality of our republic or the nature of our government or agriculture or is there anything that's useful to a society, that's the sign that you have in fact become Rome about the time that Rome began its long descent into the Dark Ages and insanity and superstition.
You're the guy nobody wants to stand next to at the party. You know that.
I understand that in your time, in your greatly debased form of America, that I would be regarded as a Puritan and maybe a prig.
We're coming to your house, and we know that the Jeffersons don't watch television or they're not into the Super Bowl, so what are you going to do to entertain us?
Well, my daughter Martha might play the pianoforte. If I could maybe be persuaded to accompany on the fiddle, and that might be, I mean, you could bring the dip and we could order pizza, and I think that could be a splendid afternoon, don't you?
Or we could go to the Hamiltons, where, by the way, they've got a fantasy league. They're betting on the games. They've got music. They've got a band. They're tailgating. I think the Hamiltons are tearing it up over across the way.
Yeah, more than they would be at my house, of course. But if you take your wife to Hamilton's party, you may never see her again.
Time travel there as we go back each Friday to talk to Thomas Jefferson. Both of those podcasts posted on my Facebook
page. Piano Forte.
You know, it's funny because I said, why do I get the feeling, and this sounds dreadful, when I go to the Jefferson party, they're all standing around with their fancy clothes saying, you know, doing puns and you know, having witty repartee. And Jefferson said, well, you won't sell 100 million tickets to that, but that can be very entertaining. But I guess that's the difference. And he said, by the way, the wine will be better at the Jefferson party than it will at the Hamiltons. You can bank on that. So a lot of folks this week were paying attention to the O.J. Simpson story because the beginning of that miniseries on FX, but there was an even shorter one on NBC, which wasn't as good at television, maybe. But I think the story is just as fascinating and actually impacted more lives. I want to talk a little, or at least more dollars, maybe not more lives. It's hard to gauge that. But I wanted to go back and talk to a woman who wrote a book about Bernie Madoff. And it's a fascinating story. And she said she'd come on with us again today. And that's after the news, which is next on WGN. Thank you, Bob. It's 2:07 on WGN. This is John Williams. The boys from the beat say hello, previewing, I presume, the Super Bowl or the ads or the Bulls or whatever they want to talk about. We'll visit with them in a little while. We'll also get to our Vibe Score segment where we score the news. Well, this wasn't exactly in the news, but again, I've just been kind of captured by this story ever since I read The Wizard of Lies a few years ago by Diana Enriquez, whose story is about Bernie Madoff, and she wrote The Death of Trust. And it was on my mind, of course, this week because of that NBC miniseries where Richard Dreyfuss played Bernie Sanders, the same week that FX... I keep saying Bernie Sanders, and
that's
I think
Larry, that's Larry David's job.
Oh, man, that's just what I do sometimes, and you're all just going to have to insert the right words.
The right Bernie.
Bernie, I love you. No, Bernie good, Bernie bad. One good Bernie, one bad Bernie. All right, where was I now? So the two series were out this week, of course. There was the O.J. Simpson one, too. And I think that was actually the better of the two teledramas, but I think the Madoff story is just fascinating. Diana, welcome back. You're on WGN again. How are you?
I'm great, John, and what a pleasure to be back with you. I do that, too, with the Bernie thing, so I'm glad it's not just
thank
me.
Thank you. You know, I did a trivia question this week about the movies, and the trivia question was about Kate Winslet, and I asked about Kate Blanchett. And if you ask a trivia question and you give the wrong question, it's really hard for the listeners to get the question right.
It is, it is. And I'm going to play copy editor again. I think it was the ABC series was the one on Madoff this week. And the O.J. Simpson series, I agree with you, was riveting. I mean, it was just... We all remember. I realize that these are stories, you know, both of them in some ways, that for younger listeners are, you know, distant history. And it's useful to see how the stories still deliver so much emotional impact, isn't it?
Yeah, no kidding. Did you watch the 4-hour series on Madoff?
I will confess that I have it taped. I had a commitment in Washington that included some evening visits with students at George Washington University, which took top priority for me. So that was kind of a super week for me. But it is evidence, I think, the popularity that it had and the viewership that it had, I think, is evidence of just the timelessness of this story. That theme of trust betrayed is just one we can't get enough of, because we all know how vulnerable we are to it.
$65 billion, is that the amount of money that Bernie made off with?
Well, yeah, most of that was fictional money, John. As you know, he made up most of that wealth out of thin air. But the people who trusted him believed it existed. They believed it was their retirement savings and their kids' college funds and everything. So it was real to them, but it was just money he made up by, you know, giving them 13% returns or 8% returns to their basic investment. And the way the Ponzi math works, unfortunately, is your loss is counted as the difference between the cash you put in and the cash you took out. So the so-called paper wealth that you lost, which is that $65 billion number, you know, the courts don't count that as a loss. But, you know, if it happened, you know, if you lost it, if I lost it, I'd feel like I lost it. One day it was in my investment account, and the next day it had gone up in smoke. So that's the number I think is the most humanly realistic price tag on this fraud.
Are you saying then that people, in fact, invested with him $65 billion of their dollars, or that was just the valuation of their accounts, however bogus that number was? And how much money went in?
The valuation of their account.
I wonder how much went in. Do we have a number on that, Diana?
We have a net cash figure that comes out of the bankruptcy court. You know, doing the math the way they do it, it's a little bit north of $17 billion. It's still the largest Ponzi scheme in history by orders of magnitude. Many times bigger than the second biggest Ponzi scheme. So at $17 billion in net cash losses, $65 billion in paper wealth that vanished, and tens of thousands of victims. We'll never know them all. The charities that had to close their doors, the pensioners of carpenters unions and iron workers unions, there was just, you know, a teacher's union in South Korea and a girls' school in St. Croix. I mean, it's just amazing the devastation and how far it reached.
Did he do it because he set out to scam people all along, or did he just get in over his head and the Ponzi scheme evolved as a way for him to, at first, recoup some losses?
I think the latter. And, in fact, I have just a hunch, and this is just a hunch, that this scheme that started rolling down the mountain and becoming so much bigger than he could ever get out of it, I don't think that was the first time he crossed over the line. I think it's possible that he had been fudging his numbers during market downturns for a while. And the reason I think that, John, is when I interviewed him in prison the first time before the Wizard of Lies, I asked him, thinking it would be a great moment to describe in the book, when he made that fatal step, you know, when he crossed the line and became a crook. You know, you'd think you'd remember that, right? It would be a life-changing moment. You think of yourself as an honest man, and then all of a sudden you've committed a crime. He couldn't remember. he couldn't describe that moment for me. It was kind of a vague process that sort of happened. He thought it would be temporary, and then it wasn't. So for whatever rationalization he had for it, he didn't have an indelible memory of that passage from honesty to dishonesty. And that makes me think that it was a trip that he may have made a few times, but that's just a hunch on my part. We do know that the Ponzi scheme lasted far longer than he admits it did. He claims it started in 1992, which is absurd. It was up and running at least by the mid to early 80s and quite possibly by the late 70s.
And when did it all come crashing down? What was the final day for him?
Well, he was the final day for him was the 10th of December when he confessed to his family. And he had a plan where he was going to go visit a lawyer the following Monday after confessing to them on a Wednesday in mid-December of 2008. His sons instead turned him into the FBI that afternoon, and he was arrested the following morning. So the world learned that Bernie Madoff was a crook on December 11th, 2008. His family learned the day before. And at that point, he was arrested. He pleaded guilty in March of 2009, was sentenced in June, as you recall, to that remarkable 150-year prison term, which he is now serving down in Butner. So.
People were giving him money, institutions, investors he didn't know, yep. But family, friends, members of his family, yeah. People he was closest yeah. to in his life were giving him millions and millions of dollars, and everybody loved yeah. Bernie because he was beating the market every single time. In fact, in the movie, and you describe this in the book as well, one of the journalists that started to look into it going, nobody does mm-hmm. that well. And mm-hmm. he said it would be the equivalent of a Major League Baseball player hitting 960. Nobody hits 960, right? So that should make us suspicious.
Well, that was the argument made. You're right, I do recount that passage in the book, but I do so a little skeptically, John, because what Bernie was really selling was consistency. There were years and years in which his returns didn't beat the S&P 500. You would have made more money in an index fund than you made with Bernie. But an S&P 500 index fund during the 80s and 90s was going to be pretty volatile. You remember the market crash in 87, and then there was another crisis in 98. So the people who invested with Bernie, by and large, were not getting market-beating returns. They were getting consistency in a volatile market. In fact, one of the biggest myths about the Madoff scandal, which I was sorry wasn't corrected, was that he attracted people because of these high, attractive returns. That's not the case. He attracted people looking for safety, not people looking for sky-high returns, which prompted a wonderful fraud analyst I know, Pat Huddleston, to say, if it sounds too good to be true, you're dealing with an amateur. So that was Bernie's insight. He didn't have to make it sound too good to be. In fact, if he had made it sound too good to be true, regulators would have been far more skeptical and suspicious than they were. So the takeaway here for listeners everywhere is, if you think you'll recognize a Ponzi scheme because it's going to sound too good to be true, that you're going to see those red flags flying. It's going to be offering you ridiculous returns. You're dead wrong. You're absolutely wrong about that. The modern Ponzi schemer has learned from Bernie Madoff. Don't ever make it sound too good to be true. Number one, that'll scare people away, and number two, it'll attract the regulator's attention. Make it sound just good enough to be attractive.
Well, it's an interesting point because I think a lot of us judge the people that were happily looking away when the returns were so good as though they're complicit in their own way, right? They were being a little bit greedy themselves.
And that's unfair. That's really unfair to them. They were seeking safety, and they trusted Bernie to deliver it, by and large. Some of his earliest investors were getting above-market returns. You know, those are folks that, you know, I treat differently in the book than I do the investors who came in through well-respected portals, hedge funds and investment advisors whom everybody respected. So that's this blame the victim thing is is sometimes justified in a Ponzi scheme, although these days, John, the kind of Ponzi schemer who is offering those ludicrous returns of yesteryear mm-hmm. is usually preying on an affinity group. It's someone who's selling that story to unsophisticated investors in his church or in her country club in some affinity group that where they can get away with it. But trying to pitch returns like that in open marketing, you know, in public marketing, that's just that's very old school. That is not the modern Ponzi approach these days.
Did his wife and how much did they know about what he was doing? Because as I recall in your book, as they showed on TV, this thing was maybe some of it was legitimate, but I mean, he was absolutely generating fake reports, even fake you know, analyses mm-hmm. of his yeah. reports, you know, like was, regulators yeah. would look into it.
Yeah, you're right, John. It was a very well-protected fraud. My conclusions in The Wizard of Lies was that neither his wife Ruth nor his two sons, Mark or Andrew, knew anything about the Ponzi scheme until their father told them about it the day before he was arrested.
What was that like? Do you have any idea, Diana, that message to his family? How did he do it and how did they react?
I do. I was able to talk with both Ruth Madoff and Andrew Madoff before his death in about that event. And it was a dramatic and an emotional moment. They went into a Bernie study in the penthouse apartment on Lexington Avenue in New York. And it's kind of a you're kind of a clubby little room, you know, with bookcases and red, dark burgundy walls and leather sofa. They all settled in there, and he kind of haltingly told them that it was all a big lie. It was a fake. It was a Ponzi scheme. He actually underestimated the price tag. He thought that he was in for $50 billion. It was $65 billion, as you said. Mark Madoff, as I think was displayed here, just went ballistic on the news. Andrew was just emotionally crushed. He was in tears on the floor. And Ruth was just stunned. I mean, she had no idea. This was totally out of left field. So I do describe that moment in the book. And I think all of us can kind of put ourselves in those shoes of suddenly discovering that someone who was the center of your life in Ruth's case and, you know, a deeply admired and respected parent in the case of his sons, is suddenly, just to suddenly discover that he is not only not what you thought he was, he's the exact opposite of what you thought he was.
Describe then the predicament, what awaited Ruth. There she was living a life none of us can imagine. And what happens to her husband and her two sons in the ensuing years?
Yeah, well, she's certainly have borne quite a burden here. She lost, as you say, has lost both her sons. She has estranged herself from Bernie. That was her decision, that she was going to cut him off in the fall of 2010. Unfortunately, that decision came too late to restore her relationship with Mark before he committed suicide. But it did allow her to reconcile with Andrew. And in the last years of his life, before he was taken very young by a recurrence of a cancer he had defeated a decade earlier, she was able to spend a lot of time with him and with his children and with her other grandchildren, Mark's family. And it is those grandchildren really now, I think, are the ballast in her life.
What's their financial situation then, Diana?
Well,
was there any money left for any of them?
No. It's their financial situation, John, is limbo, is the only word that I can come up with. The Madoff bankruptcy continues. I mean, it's going to be a decade-long process, it looks like. So the bankruptcy trustee who is liquidating their estate has filed lawsuits against Ruth, Mark's estate, and now Andrew's estate, claiming back the benefits they got from Bernie's stolen money, even though they did not know it was stolen. So they have filed those lawsuits, and they are still being negotiated. So it is unclear how much, if anything, Ruth will emerge with. So right now, she's sort of on an allowance from the bankruptcy court to cover, you know, negotiated living expenses. But she doesn't own a home. She's staying in a property that Andrew had owned, which, of course, the trustee, you know, has claimed that he expects to seize it as part of the recovery. So it's still very much in limbo, and I know that's been very frustrating for everybody in the family, but bankruptcy court has been frustrating for a lot of investors as well.
There you go. You want to be frustrated? How about you don't have any money and you didn't do anything wrong, and that's the people that entrusted it to Bernie Madoff.
Absolutely.
The book is Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff, and the Death of Trust. If you thought Big Short was interesting, wait till you see or read this one. It's not just out, but I presume it's still out. Diana, we can still get a copy of it?
You absolutely can. In fact, I'm delighted to see it's climbing up in Amazon's numbers. So, yes, it's available both in paperback and in Kindle on Amazon or through my website, which is dianabhenricus.com. You can get you can read a chapter there. You can get an idea of what it's like.
Nice to talk to you again, Diana. Thanks for your time.
Lovely, John. Thanks for having me.
The Wizard of Lies. It's 2:24. This is WGN. There's a scene in the book, and there was also in the movie, where one of these journalists who's figured it out, one of these quants, one of these quantitative, brilliant math guys, he had done the numbers. He looked at the S&P. He looked at Bernie Madoff's returns in his models, and he said, It's almost virtually impossible that what he's saying is correct. He has to be committing a crime. He has to be cheating here. And not everybody understood what he was talking about, but he persuaded his boss that if they went to a regulator and he dumbed down the presentation enough, the regulators would see it, and then they would pursue Bernie Madoff, who is a golden child on Wall Street. You don't want to go knock on Bernie Madoff's door and tell him that he's committing a crime. That's terrible. You'd better have your ducks in a row. So they do the presentation, and he's got these whiteboards and charts, and he's trying to explain it. And the math he's doing, and they told him, make it understandable, was so excruciating. His vocabulary and his references were so obtuse that they all just kind of rolled their eyes and sent him on his way. And for a while, nobody believed him. That is, the whistleblower. They all said, we don't know what you're saying, but we'll throw in with Bernie. The truth was the obvious opposite of that, wasn't it? KellyCruises.com is a website you can go to right now. I just talked to the gang over at Kelly Cruises the other day. You know, Brenda and I are leading a group on a cruise, a riverboat cruise down the Danube. I told you about that late last year. There are 18 spots left on our boat. Everybody on our boat, it's about 160 people, will be WGN listeners, John Williams listeners. And I thought we were full. We have 18 slots left in three different price ranges. So if you want to come, and boy, this sounds like one you want to come on, in the fall, going down the Danube, call 630-990-1111, or maybe more simply today, go to kellycruises.com, kellycruises.com. On the top, there's a button that says specials. Click on that, and you can find out more. Let's find out more WGN Radio News coming up next. Thank you, Bob Kessler. It's John Williams on WGN Radio. The boys from the Beat Talk Sports in about 15 minutes with us will preview their show. We're bumping here with a little Lady Gaga because Gaga is going to sing the national anthem at the Super Bowl. And on Vibe Score, this is our Vibe Score segment, we asked you to give us on a scale of 1 to 100, how do you feel about her doing the national anthem? 1 to 100. 100 would be, hooray, she's doing the national anthem. 0 would be, there goes the Republic. So far, Lady Gaga doing the national anthem is getting a 76. Meaning people are pretty favorable about Gaga singing the national anthem.
She can sing.
Oh, she can. I think that's the surprising thing. Eventually, everybody comes to that realization. You go, whatever you think about Gaga, you got to admit, she's a surprisingly good singer.
I gave her a 97 because that queen can slay.
It's Kristen Decker. Griffin, what did you give it? Our producer, Griff, what's your Vibe Score for Gaga doing the national anthem?
Yeah, I went high, too. I think you're right. She's proven that she can put on a pretty great television performance a bunch of times. So Why doubt her now?
I hope she doesn't have some ridiculous costume. Because in a way, the pageantry of Gaga is more for the halftime show or her own show.
But
the national anthem is different.
She hasn't been doing that recently. She's gotten more serious.
Has she?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's been a few years since the meet
dress. If she comes
out
like George Washington in drag, then I'm completely changing my vote.
It's been a few years. No, Kristen's right. It's been a few years for her in that. She did those collaborations with Tony Bennett and stuff, so I feel like this will probably, you know, we'll see, but I think it'll be a little more classic.
I love the Tony Bennett stuff, but I'm just saying, if she comes out in a meat suit, I'm going to want them to...
What's more American than that?
We could throw her on the Barbie. Okay, so Gaga singing the national anthem, a 76. Let's stay on the Super Bowl theme here on VibeScore. VibeScore is one word, VibeScore. You can get this app at the App Store. My cousin Tom Hegberg and I invented it, and it's there for you and us to score the news. Who's going to win the Super Bowl? You had two choices, of course. If you gave zero to the Carolina Panthers, if you moved the scoring wheel all the way to the left, that would score for the Panthers. You could score it all the way to the right. 100 would be the Denver Broncos. If you think it's too close to call, you'd rate it a 50. Right now, it's scoring a 37. 37 means that the wheel is almost halfway over to the Carolina side, which sounds about right. I'd go even more to the left. I think I'd turn that thing to about a 10. I think Carolina's going to win. How about you, Griff?
Yeah, I think so, too. Only because people who know more about it have said that to me. So,
ask me who I want to win. It's the Denver Broncos.
I don't care. I'm excited for the game. I think that's both good stories, but I don't care. But I do think the Panthers have a good shot.
Yeah, I pick Carolina to win just because I know nothing about football, and a sorority sister of mine lives in Carolina, so I said, well, why not? Let's vote for them.
Yeah, if it was a team that I thought, oh, man, I really want to watch because I care about this player or this team, you know, it would be Green Bay, it would be Chicago, it would be teams in our division, Minnesota, it would be maybe Peyton Manning and the Broncos. That's, you know, he's a national story. The Patriots would be a team that would make you really interested in the outcome. But I think those of us who follow the NFL casually aren't as into the Carolina Panthers, say, as the real sports heads out there.
I'm more into the chips and dip.
Well, now that I think about it, I kind of want Peyton to win just so he can move on. I feel like if he gets that win, he'll be a little more comfortable retiring. And I like Peyton, but I do feel like, man,
I think if his spine got to vote, if his neck got to vote, I worry for him. Who won bigger in Iowa? It was a virtual tie. By the way, there's no such thing as a virtual tie. If I get 49.6% of the vote and you get 49.3% of the vote, I beat you. They don't say after the end of a very close Super Bowl game, so the Broncos won by 1 point in a virtual tie. No, the Broncos won by 1 point. Hillary Clinton won the Iowa caucus. That's the truth of that. Okay, now I'm taking exception with the question. So we said, who was a bigger winner in Iowa? Was it Hillary because she won, or was it Bernie because he made it so close? Who do you think has bragging rights coming out of Iowa?
Hillary.
Well, I think it's Bernie. I think it's Bernie.
The people voted a 27, which was on the Bernie side, so they agree with you, John.
Right, that whatever the number was, Hillary won, but Bernie's probably got more to say about that coming out. In the movies category, we threw Brooklyn in there this week. Brooklyn, why, Griff? Is that just the latest one that's up there right now?
Yeah, just nominated for Best Picture. And
oh, yeah.
I think we're going to go through all those on VibeScore.
And it was one of the nominees in the SAG Awards, although in the SAG Awards, the Best Picture went to Spotlight. We asked you to score Brooklyn this week, and it's getting a deserved 91. Are we all on page with that? That's a great movie,
I haven't
right?
seen it yet, but this makes me more excited to see it.
Oh, you should. Are you guys up to speed on the SAG Awards In Memoriam segment that Susan Sarandon did?
Oh, yeah.
Where she's in a white kind of silky blazer and a black bra.
Yep.
They talked about it on Kathy and Judy, didn't
they?
Yeah.
And what was their take on that? Did they think that was inappropriate dress?
Yes, for the Well, we kind of went back and forth. It was inappropriate for presenting the in memoriam. But then once you think about it, she's not showing any more than all of the ladies in those plunging neckline dresses. So it's really not that bad, I guess.
I think, yeah, I disagreed when we were talking about that this week. I kind of am on the side that says if you're not going to wear that to a funeral, then you probably shouldn't be doing an in memoriam segment with that, you know? I know it's Hollywood.
It's a sad moment in a silly award show, right? Like, it's not a funeral. Yeah. I thought it was fine.
I was watching Top Chef last night. Did you guys happen to watch the latest issue of Top Chef? So who's the real pretty lady on Top Chef, Griff?
Padma.
So she's sitting there trying the food out at one of the tables they've set up. Oh, my God, was she flashing the twins. And she's beautiful. She's great television. But the guy sitting across from her, he could barely keep his eyes on his own lamb chops because he was it was beyond distracting. And I'm like, well, this is just a cooking show. Who gives a rip, right?
But that's why people love that Italian cook. But now I can't think of her name. Giada.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with being pretty, and I don't even, but it was just like, it was so calling attention to them that it was literally distracting to the purpose of the show. It's like every time they cut to her, we're supposed to be thinking, oh, I wonder what she thinks of those lamb chops. And all you're thinking of is boobs. Look at those boobs. Look at those boobs.
I hear you on this. I don't think the ratings suffered. That's just a guess.
All right. On the What's Up category on Vibe Score, we posted the video of that Wiener Dog commercial, which I'm so in love with. It's called Wiener Dog Stampede. It's for Heinz. You see a bunch of Wiener Dogs sprinting through a field, galloping, as it were. But all of the dachshunds have bun costumes, and they're running towards giant bottles of ketchup.
I love it.
You don't even have to watch it now. How can you not love that concept? How fun is that? I gave it a 90, and for some reason, it's only scoring a 63.
Why did you give it a 90? Why not higher?
Because I don't believe in 100. So
I give it 98.
I don't break out the 100 that often, but I did for this one. This is perfect. But there were some zeros and some 20s.
What?
Some people didn't like it. I don't really know why.
Pit bull owners. Or maybe vegetarians. I don't know. Somebody.
Or Chicagoans who don't put ketchup on their hot dogs.
Maybe that was it. They shouldn't be running. There was a mustard bottle, though, too, Dex. So I
maybe
I
there's
can't
something
understand that.
Mildly disturbing about thinking about eating a whole dachshund. Putting that. Maybe that's it.
I know. I own two, and at times I think you'd look delicious on the grill, but that is kind of disgusting. The people versus OJ. One episode in the can, people are really talking about that. On Rotten Tomatoes, its approval rating is 96% approve of it.
I don't care about Rotten Tomatoes. I only care about Vibe Score. What does Vibe Score say?
We are giving it a, what is it getting? 82.
82, yeah.
Okay.
82. I gave it a 90, and I'll bet that number goes up as more and more people get on board. We asked you if you were happy to see Marco Rubio surging in the polls. 100 would be yes, go Rubio. And a 0 would be we're doomed by his rise. I gave him a 60. I'm happy to see Rubio starting to essentially edge Trump out, and I think he can beat Cruz as well. I think that's good for everybody if Rubio rises.
Agreed.
Rahm's trustworthiness, 1 to 100. Did you see the number he got on this, Decker? What would you guess Vibe Score users are scoring Rahm for trustworthiness?
Probably a 45.
Lower. He's pulling a 22.
Ooh. Well, I did give him a 0.
Yeah, that didn't help.
I don't trust him.
Well, I don't think you're alone in that. Vibe Score is one word, VibeScore. You can get it for free at the App Store. Sign up, follow various groups that are of interest to you, and we'll then repeat your scores. We'll score the news on Saturday. It's 2:48 on WGN. I'm John Williams. What are the boys in the beat talking about? Little Super Bowl preview, maybe? That's coming up next on WGN. 2:52. Let's see if Kevin and Mark are around. Mr. Powell, Mr. Carmen, are you guys over there?
We fired Powell. Adam Hoag, who is the originator of the beat, is here, John. We have upgraded. Powell is out. Hoag is in. I kid. Right. I kid.
Hi, John.
All right, hold on a second. I'm getting my little thing out. So Carmen in, Hoag in as well.
Yes. We should take attendance every week, I think, when we get here.
Hoag is in. Well, I'm not looking at you guys, which is maybe a beneficial to both of us. So are you guys ready for the Super Bowl? Are you almost Super Bowled out now because they promoted so much?
I'm actually excited. I think it's going to be a great game. Adam's Mr. Football. He may be footballed out, but I'm looking forward to this one, John.
I'm looking forward to the game, but I do get tired of the whole.
Well, that's, people, I guess, it too, right? Yeah, I mean, I watch a little CB. My go-to show on in the morning on TV is the CBS Morning News. I think it's a good show, but man, you can sure tell their network's got the game because they've been doing feature after feature on it. And you're like, just play the damn game already, you know?
Can we play a little trivia with you? I want to see what you know, John.
I know very little. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's start. In Super Bowl I, what did a 30-second commercial cost?
$75,000.
You're on the right path. Half that, $37,500. What's a 30-second spot for Super Bowl 50?
$5 million.
That's exactly correct, John.
Ding, 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 ding.
King John to the mountaintop. Never, ever downplay yourself again.
That was impressive.
Wasn't that?
Can I give you guys, here's the one trivia question I heard about Super Bowl I. What was the price of a ticket? Face value.
I know the answer. Adam Hoag, what do you got?
$65.
It was $12, and people thought that was outrageous.
Well, it didn't sell out, right? There were empty seats for the first Super Bowl.
It was not a sellout. That's true.
I believe 61,000 in attendance, which is 2/3 full at the Coliseum back in the day.
Can you imagine? And I forget who the two quarterbacks were, but I saw a video from the game this week, and there's the starting quarterback for one of them, and he's just sitting on the bench, you know, with those old cleats, smoking a cigarette.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Well, the 30 for 30 on the Bears that came out this week.
How many
of those shots did you have Ditka? Wasn't there a shot of Ditka like at practice with a cigarette in his hand?
That I didn't even notice that.
Oh yeah, he's like yelling out commands, and he's got a heater in his hand. And I'm going like, I cannot picture John Fox today during a practice with a cigarette in his hand.
Didn't like NBA coaches smoke on the sidelines too? I want to feel like Jerry Sloan or somebody used to like smoke cigarettes and coach basketball. Did that happen?
Well, imagine lighting up a cigar when you think that the team has won. I mean, and the hot sweaty was it in Boston?
Red.
That's kind of weird too. What did you guys think of the 30 for 30? Is it everything we'd hoped it would be?
I loved it. I think Mark loved it too.
I did. I actually got a little bit of emotional at the very end there. That was
it's a tearjerker at the end.
How did they resolve the Walter not getting to score a touchdown? I mean, what did they say about that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because Jared Payton is a co-host of ours, and he's at the Super Bowl, and he's going to join us at 3:30, and we're going to talk to him about that because they brought it up. So I would say very candidly, it was they didn't dodge the subject at all. After Bears win the Super Bowl, I think they even showed a shot of Walter not all that too happy in the locker room, which is kind of an amazing scene to see.
Imagine that, yeah. Well, Ditka regretted it, right?
He did.
At the end,
and Ditka talks about it in the documentary, saying it's one of those things that he just wasn't thinking about in the middle of the game. And he also says, honestly, he didn't think it would matter as much to Walter as it obviously did. And knowing that in retrospect, he definitely, to this day, still has regrets about that.
Huh. Well, I don't know the answer to this, but I'll be interesting to hear it then. I wonder what his son thinks about that, because maybe he's, time and distance can heal a lot of wounds. I wonder how Jared feels about that now.
I can give you a little bit of a sneak peek, because I did have a discussion with Jared about this the other day. He didn't think that it needed to be addressed as much as it was in the film.
Really?
So that's a little bit of a teaser, and we'll get into it with him in depth at 3:30.
Well, then he might just be a little bit uncomfortable with the whole deal, right? I mean, I think if I was Jared Payton, I would feel uncomfortable about that subject and wanting to get probably as far away from it as possible. But
well, it's just a footnote. I mean, if you talk about Walter Payton's career, that's a trivia question. The main thing is, the
he was
best halfback ever. I mean, come on.
He was pretty good at football.
Yeah, well, but I mean, I don't know exactly how to describe him. Best halfback ever isn't right, but didn't you love – what was your favorite thing about Walter Payton's game? To me, it was how he'd bounce up after a hard hit. He never
right.
– there was nothing dramatic about him that way. He'd bounce up, hit you on the butt, and say, let's do it again. Well, that was the best thing about Walter Payton.
And he went through so many years of doing that for awful football teams. I mean, people forget that the Bears were terrible until Buddy Ryan and Mike Ditka got there. And so – you know, that not to get it circle back around too much on this, not getting a touchdown on the Super Bowl, but one of the guys in the film, I want to say it's Mongo, maybe I'm forgetting who it was in that point in the film, said, look, this guy sacrificed his body for over a decade for the McCaskies, for everybody, and you get there and it's that moment and he doesn't get to go in the end zone. And there's something wrong about that. And so I see that side of it too.
I think my favorite part about Payton was over the top, John. I mean, as a kid, everybody, I was 12 years old. We would be leaping over the couches and
everybody
all that.
Everybody did that.
Right?
My mom called them the flyovers. Whenever we get to the goal line, she'd say, have Walter do the flyover. And he'll just, which, you know, is really the play that Perry scored on. We could have done a flyover and scored right there.
I mean, how sweet was that? That was fun.
All right, guys. Oh, have a terrific show. You're on a good roll already. I'll be listening for that as well. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
That's Adam Hoge, Mark Carmen. This is John Williams. Let's catch you up on the news next on WGN.